Sekina.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the new tennis podcast with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. Well, welcome to another edition of Rock and Roll Tennis. I'm here with my main man from sunny Florida, the Sunshine State. Yes, John Flossy Lloyd. I call him the Bronzed Adonis because of his beautiful bronzed suntan, of course, from all the hours of playing on court in the lovely Florida sunshine. Now, this week, John, we've got a friend of yours on. It's an all-English affair. I'm kind of the odd one out because you and this guest are from Essex, which is something we can talk about. In fact, John, why don't you introduce her? Come on.
Well, I mean, she's one of my favourites. I mean, if she's without a doubt the most accomplished broadcaster. She has come such a long way in such a short time now that she even commentates in Australia, for heaven's sake. They even allow in Australia to commentate. That just shows you how good she is. And she was a hell of a tennis player in her own right as well. And she is absolutely fabulous. I adore her. The lovely Samantha Smith, Sam Smith is what we call her.
Welcome, Sam.
Thanks, John. No, thanks. Thanks for having me. I think all your listeners will be so disappointed it's not Sam Smith, the singer. But hey, you know, I'll do my best. That was very, very kind of you, John. Not bad from Buckerstill in Essex after all these years. So I'm very lucky. And actually, Keith, you're stuck in an Essex sandwich as a North Londoner. It's not always a good place to be.
Definitely not. I think, obviously, there are probably people listening to us in America itself and around the world. So why don't you explain, both of you, but you first, Sam, because you are an Essex girl. What does that mean? Because there are certain, can we say, stereotypes or certain... It's an expression, isn't it? Essex girl, we've got an Essex lad and John. Come on, divulge all.
Well, I'm of the opinion that Essex is still the best county. And John will be nodding as well. I'm from the west part of Essex, so East London borders. So I should have a bit more of a London accent than I do, but I think I've been travelling so many years, it's kind of knocked the rough edges off, and probably school as well. And John's from the coast, so he's from the eastern part of Essex. And it's like one road to get it towards London. It's an absolute nightmare. But the area I come from is full of West Ham fans, the Premiership Club West Ham fans. And what I like about Essex is people are really down to earth. That you know, they'll call a spade. In fact, they'll call a spade an effing spade, actually. It's just probably more like it. And I always have a joke, actually, with a fellow Essexite, Mark Petchy, who's also a brilliant broadcaster, good friend of John's. I mean, it was a great, in my day, and particularly in John's day, I mean, John was a million times better tennis player than me, but Essex was one of the strongest counties for tennis. You know, year after year, we'd win, you know, the county, inter-county championships and loads of national winners. But they always say, but Essex has got a reputation of being a bit dodgy. And what Mark Petchy and I always say, you know, the whole country, on average, probably the breakdown between cash and credit cards is about 90% credit cards, 10% cash, 80-20. It just flipped that for Essex. You know, it's a bit, you know, it just feels like everything's fallen off the back of a lorry. It's got that kind of feel. There was in the 80s a sort of key Essex wardrobe. I mean, Essex girls are quite, I think, morally flexible, potentially, like wearing white stilettos and have quite interesting hairdos, I would say. And they don't feel the cold on the South End seafront in the middle of winter.
No, evidently not.
That's Essex for you.
A bit like up in Newcastle. But in terms of Essex girls and Essex lads, I feel a little bit sort of the odd one out here, you know, being a North London lad, I guess. But you're not the ordinary Essex girl, Sam. I mean, you know, that stereotype you just talked about, you are somebody with, I understand, a 2-1 in history. Is that correct?
It is. Amazingly so.
Wow. And you took 3 years out of tennis to do your degree, which is, you know, very impressive. But can I ask you, why didn't you go to somewhere that John always raves about? Why didn't you do college tennis in the States?
Well, with hindsight, I think it would have been quite a good option for me for my tennis. But why I went was because, so I didn't play that much. I'm actually originally a swimmer. And I didn't play that much. And John will know what it was like. I mean, John had, you know, his brother David and Tony, his dad was a coach and everything. But it's still very difficult to get practice partners. And you never get enough high quality tennis in terms of tournaments and practice. It was all really sketchy. And I didn't play an awful lot until I was about 14 or 15. And then I would go up and down. If you wanted to sort of play indoors, because we didn't have indoor courts then. I don't think you had any indoor courts, did you, John?
No, Queen's Club was the closest.
Yeah, so Queen's would be even further from John than it was from me. I was about an hour and a half on the underground. I used to go up there three times a week for a wonderful lady called Shirley Brasher, who I was incredibly lucky to have her coach me. And she would sort of peer at my tennis. And she's a former French Open champion, one of the best in the world in the 50s. And she would peer at this rather unruly game, which consisted of, like, you know, drop shots and crazy shots. I had no idea what I was doing, but I enjoyed hitting the ball. So I was doing that for a lot of years, and it was a grind. And also, we needed the money to keep, you know, if I could have any sponsors, or there was some quite good prize money in some of the junior tournaments as well. And I was playing like under the 21 events, and effectively, I just needed the money to keep going. So that I wasn't eligible to go and play American tennis, because it's obviously very strict and you have to be an amateur. And I think it was maybe mentioned, but, you know, I think that the horse had already bolted by then. So, and also I think I had a very sort of traditional education. I'm not sure, and I can't add up whatsoever. So I don't think I would have passed the SAT. I'm not bad with words, but I am useless at maths. So I don't think I would have passed the SAT anyway. So that was, you know, I don't think anyone was too worried about it. So I think to have a more traditional education was better. But I was really chomping at the bit. I finished my A-levels when I was 17, and I just wanted to play. I was desperate to get going. So that's why I went and played tennis. And, you know, I think there were more, you know, college tennis was in the background. But when you looked at the detail, it wasn't going to happen. But it would have been great, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would have improved you as a player? Because obviously taking those 3 years out must have affected your tennis career to some degree, I would presume, correct me if I'm wrong, to your detriment.
A little bit of both. So going to college would have been great for me as sort of personal development, because at 17, 18, I was a very extremely immature person. And I'd just come out of school, which was very structured, and my tennis was very structured and organized by Shirley, and my parents sort of controlled everything. And I was just not mature enough and ready to be on the tour and to organize myself. And I went to the States actually when I turned pro in an academy, and it wasn't like a Bolotteras. It was a small academy, and I was sort of left to look after myself, and I couldn't cook, and I just couldn't manage myself at all. And I just found it really difficult to be. So I was away from home, and then I'd go to the tournaments, and then I'd come back to a sort of shared house situation, which was always chaos. If you can imagine kids looking after themselves, and it wasn't really a home. I just had a bunk bed in the corner. And that kind of got to me. I'm not a homesicky person, but it was like I just felt I had nothing, no anchors at all. Mm. And after about a year and a half, I just felt, I mean, I was doing well. I got to around about 100 in the world. I was beating good players, but I wasn't enjoying it. And I'd love junior tennis, and I was, you know, mad for tennis. But I just thought, this is awful. And I could see all my friends at university, and I just, you know, at that age, I just thought, you know, kind of stuff it. I'm not going to do it anymore. So that's why I went to university with no interest in coming back at all. That was it. I'd had my roll of the dice, and that was it. So in a way, going to college would have been great, because it would have been more structured. I'd have got my education. I would have grown up. And probably then at 21, 22, I would have been way more ready for the tour. And because once I'd finished my degree, I decided I might as well play again. And I was a completely different person.
It's interesting. I mean, I must tell you something, Sam. I mean, I was 15.
John's falling asleep on. He's on a bed. He's on this magnificent bed. Are you asleep there, John?
No.
Okay.
I was just saying that I was 50 a few weeks ago, and I still haven't grown up. So you didn't need to worry about that, Sam. Believe me. Well, you know, it's interesting because you guys obviously former pros, and Sam, you talk about the fact that you didn't really like being out of your roots. Even though we weren't so homesicky, but we haven't talked about this, John. You know, touring the world and living out of a suitcase. How hard that must be. I mean, surely that's tough.
Well, as Sam says, you know, you've got to sort of grow up, and you know, I left school at 15 and a half for the first day I was legally allowed to, with absolutely no qualifications. And because I convinced myself I was going to be a player, and there was no money in the game then, it was very stupid of myself to do that. And I got lucky, to be honest. There was a lot of luck that came my way. But when I first started traveling at 16, 17, I was tremendously homesick. And a lot of times, to be honest, I'd be away and I'd be almost happy to lose, because the happiest thing in those days was Heathrow Airport and arriving back home. I mean, that's how bad it was. And my father, who was not I wouldn't call him a sort of in-your-face kind of parent at all, but one day he basically sat me down at, I think I was about 17 and a half, and he said, look, John, you know, I understand you're a family lad and all this, and you've got all your friends here, and, you know, we're a close family, but if you're going to be homesick, you've picked the wrong profession. When you're going to be traveling 40 weeks a year. So you've got to make your mind up what you want to do. You either change. And from that day on, I actually learned to cut things off. And it, all the way through, even, you know, when I was playing and later on when I was married and stuff, I had kids, and it was tough to go on the road. But as soon as I left, I immediately cut them off. It doesn't mean I wouldn't call them or miss them, but I had a job to do, and it was business. And so it was a quick learning curve. And about 17 and a half, I grew up. And then after that, I embraced it and then loved traveling. And now, up to this day, I mean, after 3 weeks of being in one place, I get antsy. I love getting on the road. Unfortunately, it's been a bit difficult at the moment. But it's a learning. But on being on the tour is definitely – things have changed now than when Sam and I played. I'm not putting Sam in my group because she's way younger than me. But in my day, particularly in Sam's, to a certain extent, you know, there wasn't the money that there certainly is now. There wasn't the support groups that you have now. The entourage is whether that's all the time healthy or not is debatable. But things are organized for you. So you kind of got groups. In my day, you're kind of, I mean, my friends were people that I met on the tour, and a lot of times, quite honestly, they were a lot older than me. Well, in terms of when I say a lot older, I mean, I was 17 and hanging out with 25, 26-year-olds, which is a big gap at that stage. But you kind of get used to it. But it can be a lonely life for a while there until you embrace it and then realize that, you know, there's some wonderful things to it if you really, you know, go for it and not sort of be too introverted about things.
What's your experience, Sam?
Yeah, I think Keith, John made a really important point there about the support, because I always loved traveling as a junior, and I loved the traveling part when I first turned pro. That for me, that wasn't the issue. The issue was I just lacked life skills, because when you're very busy as a junior, I was at a really academic school, and I was trying, and I was a pretty decent junior, international junior. I didn't really have, you know, I mean, food appeared. I didn't know where it came from, and washing got done. And I didn't have the time, really. My parents were amazing, sort of keeping that all from me. But then once you're suddenly, you know, in your first year at university, I was in hall, so you're given a bit of support. But I was literally 17 in the States being a pro, and I'd come back to the shared house, the shared kitchen. I'd come back off these tournaments. I may have lost, or I might be slightly injured. And I just had to go and like go to the supermarket, cook, and I couldn't cook, and I didn't know how to use the washing machine. And you know, it just was just, I wasn't with people I was particularly close to. It just felt incredibly, I just, you know how Rafa always says he needs to go back to Mallorca and plug in with his friends and his family. I just had, I mean, the girls I was on the tour in the squad were great, but they weren't, I'd only just met them. A lot of it was Patricio Appe's Tennis Academy in Key Biscayne. A lot of it was all sort of very Spanish. I mean, there was just a lot of new things. And I didn't really know what to, I didn't know much about diet, but I'd always been eating very well as I'd grown up because my parents made those decisions. But they just seemed, I was overwhelmed with not the tennis, but the life skills that you need on tour. And I was also sort of trying to run a semi sort of home. And I just couldn't, it, funny enough, all that just eroded my sort of spirits, which I'd always been quite spirited, and I just couldn't, you know, it just was so, it was absolutely soul destroying at times. After a year and a half now, I was like, I don't really want, I don't want this. You know, you have a few bad results.
Did it affect your game, Sam?
Sorry?
It must have affected your game.
I don't think it affected my game. It just affected me as a person. And then I stopped enjoying everything. It was just too much to cope with too young.
Yeah.
That's interesting, John, isn't it? We had Tony Adams on last week who runs Sporting Chance. I'm sure you've heard of it, which is now working with the ATP. And we talked about, you know, mental health and professional sportsmen, the pressure. But in tennis, it's very different. It's that sort of being out there on your own, on court on your own, without the help of a coach or a team or a family. And, of course, the travel without your family, unless you, again, you have an entourage like some of the very elite top players. So it is, it's a difficult life, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult. And obviously, you know, when you turn on the TV and you magazines and so on, you see... You see the upper echelon of players, and obviously it's pretty good for them. But the lower ones and players that are trying to make it in the challenges and the smaller futures events and so on, it can be a lonely life there. And there's not much money around, and you get beaten up regularly, playing wise, and you know, there's not the support groups around you, and it can be soul destroying. So you've got to be a pretty strong character to come through that and to want it enough and hang in there enough to succeed. So at the top end, it's pretty comfortable, but when you start getting, you know, down to the lower rankings and so on, it can be pretty difficult down there. There's no question about it.
And then, of course, Sam, you like John, you had a breakthrough after your tennis playing career finished into the broadcasting world. How did you get the gig?
Well, it wasn't something I never intended to do. I mean, I always liked, like John and I love TV, and I know John's a huge movie buff, and I've always loved tennis. But I, at the end of my career, I had a really nasty ankle injury, and I had massive surgery, like reconstructed ligaments and bone shaved. It was a mess. And not quite as bad as John's hips or his knees, but not far away. That's not, I think it's scientifically not possible. But so I had a big operation, and about three or four days later, I mean, I was still, I think, really all over the place from the anaesthetic. My agent phoned up and just said, "Oh, I don't want you sitting around, you know, doing nothing. It's not good for you." And he said, it was just at the time when there was a proliferation of cable television in the UK, and Eurosport was one of the sort of up and coming channels that had been going a few days. And he said, "Look, and also when you have a major injury, I mean, I was 2 or 3 months non weight bearing. It was going to be 6 to 9 months before I even had a chance to play again. You can't really go and get a job because you have to do physio. You've got the pain to deal with. You know, and you don't know how long the process is going to take. So you can't really go and get an actual job, and you can't coach, which is probably the only thing you're really qualified for." So he said, "Oh, I'll get you into the commentary." So literally I went up in a taxi in a plaster cast, still out of it from the anaesthetic, and I did commentary. It was probably the best way to do it. I mean, I felt nothing.
No nerves.
And I'm sure I was terrible. But the lovely thing was, and it was a great experience, I was with a good friend of mine and John's, a broadcaster called Chris Bradnam. And I'll always be really grateful. I mean, you know what Chris is like. He's such a paternal kind of guy. He looked in horror at me. And he made a special like stall for my, you know, with boxes and books for my leg because it had to stay up. And he turned my microphone on and off. And he was just so like, he just looked after me for those couple of days that I did it. And I quite enjoyed it. And I didn't really think much more of it because it was only just sort of very temporary. But my first experience was really good.
No, that helps a lot. Yeah, Chris is brilliant. He actually was the commentator that helped me out when I fell asleep live on air. And Chris got me out of it. We were doing the Olympics the Beijing Olympics, but we were doing it from a studio in...
I was there with you. Yeah, you I was there, asleep on the floor. Do you remember that?
We were doing it at like 4 o'clock in the morning and I'd flown in from California and my flight got delayed by a day, so I literally hadn't any sleep and we're in the middle of it was a shocking match. I actually don't mean to say anything, Sam, but I think it was the ladies' doubles, believe it or not. Not that I'm against ladies' doubles, but it was the worst match in history. And it got towards the end of the match in the third set and we were in this dark dungeon of a studio and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I remember I turned to Chris and I turned my mic. I said, Chris, I'm going. I don't know if I can hold on. And I'm doing the Mr. Bean. I'm holding my eyes open. And he's, you know, Chris is very pro and he's Mr. Enthusiastic. I mean, Chris could be enthusiastic about commentating in one of my matches if I was playing today. That's how good he is. And he was going rabbiting on about his ladies' doubles. I couldn't even pronounce the names. And I started going and it got into a tiebreaker in the third. And I suddenly just went. And I snored and he nudged me and I woke up and I didn't know where the hell I was. I didn't know where I was. I'm in this black room and Chris is rambling on. Where am I? And luckily I had my mic off and he suddenly sort of coached me through it and got me through it and held it on for 4 or 5 points until I regained what little sanity I had left. But anyway, I love Chris.
I was going to say, Keith, during that was a couple of weeks we were there for that Olympics. We were actually in BBC studios in Kensington, I think, and they made up a dressing room for us. It wasn't even a proper commentary studio, and I would have been no help for Chris at all with John asleep because I was literally in a sleeping bag snoring on the floor waiting for my shift.
BBC Chris commentator. On his own.
Oh, my word. Well, John is full of stories. I don't know if you know, Sam, that John's obviously got his book coming out. Well, it'll be 2021, John, and he's got all these types of stories. And I have been privy to some of the chapters on Microsoft Word. It's almost like reading off a Kindle in modern day terms. But, John, how did you get into commentary again and broadcasting?
Well, I got sort of thrown in at the deep end, sort of a little bit like Sam was saying. It would have been better for me if I'd just had surgery because, you know, I would have been better as well. But when I did it literally because I was just sort of floating around. I was playing some odd little exhibitions and a bit of team tennis, but I'd been retired. And my agent told me that there was a possible opening at HBO because the late, great Arthur Ashe had passed away. And, you know, would I be interested? And I was like, gosh, commentating, I don't know. I don't know whether my vocabulary is good enough for that stuff, but... anyway, they fixed it up and I did a screen test with a guy called Jim Lampley, who's very well known in America for doing boxing commentary. And I didn't know what a screen test was. And he said, yeah, you'll go in a room with him and you'll do a live pretend, but it will be a live match you'll be commentating on and we'll see how you go. And I was just horrendous. I remember I kept, you know, they had the earpiece on and they'd be telling me instructions in my ear and they would say something like, okay, John, at the end of this game, Lampley's next to me, you know, not a commercial break, but another court. And I said, oh, okay. And they said, no, you can't say okay. I said, right. He said, no, you can't say anything because you're not supposed to be talking. People have just heard you say that. And so I kind of got that. I was awful. It's so bad, but somehow I managed to sneak the job and it was lucky because, you know, on cable, on HBO, you can kind of wing it and they allowed you to, I mean, you could even like swear. And a couple of times I made a few faux pas. They actually encourage you on HBO. So you could make mistakes, whereas the BBC, you couldn't have done that stuff. So it was a good learning curve for me to sort of try and learn my craft. And then from there, after about 7 years, HBO stopped tennis, and I went on to the BBC after that, and have been there ever since.
Mm. I mean, Sam, you've been with the Beeb, you've been with Sky, now you're obviously with Amazon, and I know you work with an Australian network. But I mean, I guess I shouldn't ask you who you prefer to work for. But how do you think the tennis coverage has changed? I mean, when you watch Wimbledon, it's very basic. And I don't mean basic in a bad way. As John would say, it's catered for the Wimbledon fan. And we've had an episode on this podcast where Wimbledon fans are not tennis fans. And you can see that from the tennis coverage you get from the BBC. Whereas when you watched Sky and now Amazon, the detail with the statistics, with the heat maps and so forth, is really extensive. How do you feel working in that kind of environment? I know you've been with the Beeb. What do you prefer?
Well, I think they're different skill sets and different audiences. And certainly I just made up the draws. That's how I describe my tennis career. I was an all right player, which meant that I didn't get offered a contract when I started working. I didn't get sort of put in the top matches. So what I had to do if I wanted to do it was, you know, and I think it really helped me. I started off doing night shifts at Eurosport, all the matches that no one else wanted to do. I did a bit of BBC radio. I did a bit of this, a bit of Sky. And I did a bit of everything. And then over the years, it started to sort of build up more. So it gave me quite a good sense of, so I worked with a lot of different producers and directors. I worked with a lot of different commentators and old style, new style, yeah, all sorts, which I think was really good because it didn't give me an actual sound. You know, some people you say, oh, that's definitely a BBC commentator. I don't think I'm like I belong particularly to any one network. So that's been a huge advantage. But coming back to your question, it's you have to know your audience. And I think about that an awful lot. And obviously the Amazon audience is quite a specialized audience. I think it's younger because a lot of the kids will watch on their phone. They have all these little highlights packages because the kids don't really watch a whole match, which I think is a shame because they lose any young player. I mentor an 11-year-old from Essex, John, you'll be pleased about that. And I'd keep saying, watch the whole match. You know, if you've watched the highlights on social media, you haven't watched it, you've missed the nuances. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you can sort of dig a bit deeper and you've got the challenge of explaining quite complicated things with technology, you know, in still a straightforward way, because you've still got people that probably don't understand that much about tennis. When I work for the BBC, it's often a very different team. There's a lot more. When you work for the host broadcast, so much more happening in your ear because they're coming in and out of BBC One and BBC Two. It's a lot more technical and there's an awful lot more going on. There's often three balls, which, as John knows, I mean, they can get quite complicated. There's just a lot, you know, they're heading off to the Chelsea Flower Show or something. So you've got to wrap up. And so that is, I do feel a little bit like it's going back in time working for the BBC. And sometimes I find that a little difficult over the years. And I do feel that it can be a little bit like Wimbledon. It can update without you really noticing that it's changed. And I think it's trying to do that, but I think it's a bit more of a push because even though the audience is maybe a lot of fans who, you know, just watch it for a couple of weeks to year. Or I hear a lot of people save up their ironing for the 2 weeks of Wimbledon. I've heard that. I do feel that there's more you can do to make it more modern and educate the audience. And I think ultimately that would make it more interesting.
Yeah, I very good point, Sam. But you know, I think these things take time. But I got to tell you, it has changed from when I first started. I'll tell you that. In comparison, when I first started at the BBC, you were very much told that basically you could not disagree with, like, as an example, the umpire or linesman. I mean, they didn't have Hawkeye. So when an umpire made a stupid error, which, you know, they certainly did more often than you would think, you had to sort of keep the party line, the Wimbledon line, so to speak. And that was at the beginning, and after coming from HBO, I was like, this is ridiculous, but you had to do that. And then gradually, especially when McEnroe came in, that things changed. And as younger producers and directors came in, they, in the end, they would say, no, you say what you need to say on that sort of stuff. And it has proved in that way. I get totally what you're saying, but and you said about the ironing, and it's not quite as much as it used to be, but I do remember, and shows you how old I am, but with the late, great Dan Maskell, who was the face of British tennis, you know, a lot of years ago, he told me, he just said, know your audience, exactly what you said, Sam, but he said 75% of the audience that watches Wimbledon, and I don't know the stats now, and I'm sure it's changed, are or were housewives, and a lot of them didn't even know how to score a tiebreaker. So he said, if you start talking about pronating this and backspin this and turning the, you know, they won't know what the hell you're talking about. So you got to learn, know your audience. And so you do have to be a little bit careful, but times have changed. But I agree with you. I think we could nudge it a little bit quicker in a more modern, more modern way. That's for sure.
John, it's so funny that you say that, because I've got to do this thing on Steffi and Serena tomorrow, just comparing their two careers. So I went back and watched the Steffi 95 final against Arantxa. It was a classic. And John Barrett, another great commentator. It's funny you should say that about the line calls, because there was a terrible call. And John was like, oh, I do believe it clipped the line. And it was it was a momentary puff of chalk, he said. And it's like, where? They showed it on the replay. Yeah. It was nowhere near the line. I also heard that they used to, back in the 70s, my former coach, Shirley Brasher, she actually commentated on the 77 final, the Virginia Wade-Betty Stowe final. And she said they actually told her in her ear what to say. Can you imagine that? I hear that's true.
I believe it. Yeah.
Well, why Sam, did Sky ditch tennis?
I'm not really sure. I think it was economics. It also depends who's at the top of Sky as well, and whether they think that the tennis is viable. And when you think, I believe the rights for the tennis cost as much as just one half of one Premiership game to show. So clearly there wasn't a lot of will at the top to keep.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's what they didn't even, as I understand, they didn't even really go for it. But I mean, obviously I'm going to say this because I work for Amazon Prime, but you know, Sky had it for 20 years. They'd had a good run at it. They did some really good things and moved it on, certainly moved it on. And Amazon, I feel, are now trying to push it on. I mean, there's only so many ways you can do tennis. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a ball going backwards and forwards in a rectangle. What are you going to do? But Amazon are, particularly with how user-friendly it is in terms of, you know, on the phone and on devices for the kids. And you can now, it's getting more user-friendly if you want to, like, I'm the generation still watches matches on like a nice big TV, and the user face is getting better, interface is getting better. You know, there was a couple of tournaments on last week in Prague and the States, and I could go back and I could watch every single match practically. I could watch little bits. I could watch highlights. So for me, as a, you know, trying to do my research, it's helpful for a young player or coaches. You can see everything now. And that's what the Amazon has given you the facility to do. Or if I'm on out and about and I really need to see something, I can just watch it on my phone.
Yeah.
I have to say, I find watching, I've got an iPhone. This isn't an advert for Apple, but it's one of the smaller ones rather than the big screen one. And if I watch football on it, it's okay. It's not like watching it on TV. When I watch tennis on it, it's not easy. It's okay. It will do.
You need a bigger phone. You need a bigger phone.
I'm thinking about that because when I'm out and I want to watch the tennis. Yeah. Two years ago, I think it was my birthday. My wife took me to a restaurant. We were in Covent Garden, and it was a Friday night, I believe, Nadal Djokovic semi-final at Wimbledon. I had to watch it, and I seem to remember having it on my birthday meal on the table on the phone watching the tennis. But that was on BBC, of course, but so it can be done. But I think you're right. I think you have to cater for the modern audience. And we had Adam Smith from Sky on some weeks ago, who you probably know. And he's got an incredible amount of ideas where he was very sad to see tennis go from Sky. And he had some very direct things to say how tennis could modernise, et cetera, didn't he, John?
Yeah, yeah, he was great. He loves the sport. Listen, you know, tennis is, let's face it, it's has a fight on its hands. There are a lot of sports. You know, we're chasing the same audience, and we have to keep one step ahead. We've done some things. Can you imagine? You know, Hawkeye. I mean, that was a huge thing, and people like Roger Federer didn't want it and hated it and all that stuff. But the audience love it. I'm as an example, I'm against on-court coaching. Always have been, always will be. But if it was shown to me that, as an example, the audience want it and they favour it, then I would say let's do it. I mean, we've got to be progressive in whatever it takes to get people coming over to watch our sport, because there's a lot of competition. And I think, as Sam said earlier on, it's tough. The Grand Slams, I always feel that they're the great showpiece of tennis, but you know, these matches are too long. At least now most of them, we've got tiebreakers in the fifth, but Wimbledon had a chance, in my opinion, to, when they finally went to tiebreakers, to do the right thing and make it to six all in the fifth set. And what did they do? They had to be different, and they made it at 12 all, which in essence, it's now best of six sets, which was just so ridiculous for me. I couldn't believe it. They've got to shorten it, not lengthen it, in my opinion. The audience these days, they've got to cater for it. People don't want to sit and watch 4 or 5 hours tennis matches on the box, I don't think, anyway.
Well, here's a question for you, Sam, and you, and both of you, because we've now, I think it's such a good time to have you on, Sam, particularly as next week sees the Project Restart, as they call the Premiership. But tennis really starts up again next week. Now, I am a huge, huge fan. I say it every week, I'm the fan, John's the man, and you in inverted commas, you are the man, because you guys walk the walk, I just talk the talk. But in all seriousness, I'm not excited about the tennis season starting up next week. To me, it all seems in vain. Now, you're working on the tournaments coming up. Give us your take.
Well, they've already had three events in smaller ones, which is probably why it's not been on your radar, in Prague, in Palermo, in Sicily, and in, of all places, Lexington, Kentucky, last week, which was, it was an oven there. If you hit, I think you're hot in Florida, John. Yeah. 10 times worse there. And it's obviously the players, you know, they're competitive animals. They were, so many were desperate to play, and there was a lot of uncertainty. And I don't think they're really, it's a bit like playing a match, isn't it? There's a lot of uncertainty without any idea of an outcome. But I don't think they were, I think they found it very difficult, all of them, young and old, across the board, because they're used to schedules. But you've also got to remember, around tennis, there's so many people that depend on the sport for their incomes, the coaches, the media, you know, whose incomes have just dropped off the bat, the umpires. There's a whole ecosystem out there. And so, and you've also got to try and save the sport. As John was saying, you know, tennis has been competing with other sports, and I think still is too conservative and needs to really get together and come up with a few more innovative ideas, and also just get the players on board a bit more with a few things that, you know, that make the sport sometimes not very, very watchable, and talk about that later. But, you know, tennis has now got to fight for its space, so it has to get back. And also, all these tournaments are losing so much money, but they can recoup a little from the TV rights, which is really the motivation for getting the US Open and the French Open on. And I think tennis has been great moving Cincinnati to New York. It seems a really weird thing. I was trying to explain to actually my coach, who's very, very old now, and he's not always in the best of health. But I tried to explain to her that Wimbledon was cancelled. And she was like, OK. And I said, the US Open hasn't got any won't have any fans. And she was like very skeptical about this. And I said, then the French Open's in October. And she was like, no, you're just having me on here. So, you know, it's a very strange world, but tennis has to get back in the fight with all the, I mean, you can see how well cricket has done, the Premiership's up and running. And it's also very important, because last week Serena and Venus Williams were in Lexington, Kentucky. And one of the big women's sport and also disability sport has taken a huge hit in these times. And it was very important to get iconic female athletes out there. You know, we're not seeing any women's soccer, not seeing any women's cricket. You know, all that's been sort of put on the back burner. But women's tennis is the by far the number one sport. They're getting the women's golf going. I think the Scottish Open was on this week. But women's sport has taken a huge hit. So it's even more important that that gets back on and in the game.
Yeah.
Are you guys excited about the restart, though? Seriously. I get all you're saying, but because in the back of my mind somewhere, I'm thinking, it's almost like when you're playing tennis, and obviously I'm just a club player, it's almost like you're really losing that set. You just want to say, okay, let's get on with the next one. And I've got this thing in the back of my mind, I just want to get on with 2021 and the tennis season then. Are you guys of the same mindset, or you just want to, come on, let's see some tennis?
Well, I mean, I just, as you know, Keith, just came back from 3.5 weeks of team tennis. And I was a part of it, but it was a great buzz for me. And we had about 200-250 spectators in our stadium during the day, but we had music going and the whole lot. And actually, I thought the atmosphere was pretty good, considering I'm skeptical of seeing it. It just mind-boggling to me to think of, you know, Djokovic out there and Serena Williams on the Flushing Meadows, you know, on the stadium court there with no one there watching. It seems, I was just thinking about that today when I was thinking to myself, well, I guess we don't have to worry about it. We're not going to have the situation, or we don't need to have the situation where Djokovic and Serena only play their matches on the stadium court, because what the hell does it matter if they're on court 20? There's going to be nobody out there anyway. And they might even prefer that, because at least it'll be more intimate. I can't imagine playing a match, let alone watching it, with no one playing, with an 18,000 capacity. I know they do it in football and it's been done, and they're pros and it'll work. I don't know. I'm skeptical. I want to see it in some ways, because I love records, and I love the fact that perhaps Serena, you know, could make it now. Although, you know, there would be a slight asterisk, I suppose, if 6 out of the top 10 have so far pulled out. And if Djokovic wins it, then he's a step closer to Federer. And I'm all about records. I love that. But I don't know. It's going to be a very strange atmosphere. I don't know whether I'm looking forward to it, to be honest. It's sort of I'm up and down on it.
Sam?
Yeah. I suppose I'd certainly beginning to work on it. I did approach it with a little trepidation before last week. I did the Jamie Murray events at the National Tennis Centre, the Battle of the Brits. And I have to say that was great, because they shortened the format. We had the players with headsets on, you know, during the match a couple of times. Once a set, we talked to the coaches who sat in the corner of the court. And a lot of people obviously were desperate to watch tennis, but I had very good feedback from people. You know, they were just really happy. I think it was a week or two before Wimbledon, so people were just so happy to see it on. I suppose it depends on how much you feel sport is about action, or how much is it about noise. And I know from commentating last week, to do long matches without any fan noise, it's very hard to keep the energy going. That was difficult. And I know that football has had fake fan noise and it's worked quite well. The snooker, which was on last week in Britain, they had a very successful experiment with fan noise. But I think tennis is more complicated. I think there's been a few discussions, or a lot of discussions about it for the US Open with some of the American networks. But I think they've decided it's just too difficult. So it's much more challenging for a broadcaster, but I'm really wanting to step up and try and do the best I can. But the onus is much more now, because you can't bounce off a crowd, you can't bounce off any noise. And it will be very strange. But I have to say, when I turned up at the Battle of the Brits, I bumped into one of the world's best tennis directors, you know, and he'd spent 3 months delivering parcels for DPD. He was absolutely exhausted, you know, just to make sure his kids and, you know, his wife, you know, had some food. I mean, So, you know, everyone was so excited, because they just needed to work. And it's the side that most people don't see about the media industry, because most of us are freelancers and everybody's incomes just fell off a cliff. And it's okay to say, oh, let's just kick it down to 2021, but we might be in the same position next year. So what do you do? Just shut up until it, you know, until everything's back to normal. I don't think you can do that, because you're just going to let esports come into the space. You're going to let, you know, so many other sports just come into the tennis space. I thought it was very interesting, the 2 weeks of Wimbledon, that the BBC and the All England were very keen to protect those 2 weeks. So they had I didn't get anything done. I did all my ironing those 2 weeks. Normally I'm working. I was a domestic goddess, and they showed old matches. They showed highlights. I went in and did an evening for them as well. And so people could keep that Wimbledon experience, because they felt very strongly that you can't lose those 2 weeks. It's part of people's, you know, yearly calendar. Oh, that's the 2 weeks of Wimbledon. And it would be the same for Americans. They've got to protect that fortnight against, I don't know when, I get very confused when all the seasons, you know, start. But, you know, the baseball season, the American football season, I believe, starts quite soon.
Yes.
So they've just got to roll the sleeves up and get in there.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that. And I heard Barry Hearn the other day, who I'm sure you know, saying, because he was criticised for bringing some fans into the final of the World Snooker, and he said, look, we've got to get back to some kind of normality. And I think you're right, Sam, you make a very important point. And, you know, there's an economy out there that needs to carry on. So, yeah, I think you may be right. We will tune in. And, of course, you, Sam, I have to say, and I don't just say it just to butter you up, I honestly really enjoy your punditry, your broadcasting. Say it with a touch of class, as does John. And another one of my favourites, of course, is Andrew Carson, who we're going to get on here, because I really enjoy his analysis as well. But yeah, I'm going to be watching. But it's interesting as well, though, Sam, because I know you're known for that. You once criticised, weren't you, for a question you asked Eugenie Bouchard? Is that right?
Yes, that was a long time. Thank you very much. You both have been incredibly complimentary. So I find it very embarrassing. And, you know, I just try not to annoy the viewer too much and do as much homework as I can and sort of respect the players and respect the game. That's kind of the only way I know how to do it. And just fingers crossed that people enjoy it. Funny enough, God, that was quite a long time ago. And I was working for Channel 7, the Australian network. I don't know how I smuggled myself onto that team, but I finagled myself on there somewhere. Yeah, and I asked, I remember actually, because the on-court interviews are like sort of walking the plank. They can go disastrously wrong, but they can go really well. And you never quite know. It's a little unpredictable. Sometimes the players don't always understand what you've said, because you always think that, and you're trying to satisfy a TV audience and the stadium audience as well. And often in these stadiums, the sound system, you get a lot of rebound from the microphone. So you can't always hear what you've said. You can't hear what they've said. And people don't realise what a complete... And you've got someone in your ear talking to you as well. So it's quite tricky. But I did, while I was doing the match, I'm hopeless. I'm very old school. But I sort of do keep an eye on social media and just see what the fans, the Channel 7 fans were saying. And you know, Jeannie is a star. She's an absolute star. The way she goes, carries herself. She's amazing with the fans. She'll sign every autograph. She looks $1 million every day. And that, you know, that's not easy. Even as beautiful as she is, that's not an easy thing to do. She has great pride in her appearance, like Sharapova, really tries to sell the game. And all the fans, I had all these fans saying, you know, saying to me, oh, you can ask, would you ask Jeannie, if she could date anybody, who would she date? So I thought, well, I went out there. You know, you often ask a tennis question, or you see what's happened in the match, I'm very keen on just looking at them in the eyes when they come off, just to see how they are emotionally. You know, sometimes they're happy to joke, sometimes they're not. And she was, I think she just made it through the semis of her first slam, and she was, you know, chilled, as any pumped and chilled. It was great, if you can be those two contrasting things, but she really was up for anything. And I just threw the question at her. And it just happened. I remember she said, she could have said anyone. I mean, I was hoping she'd say Pat Rafter. That would have been, you know, the smart thing to say. And then she said Justin Bieber, you know, who had at that time a tricky, because he's a fellow Canadian. She'd obviously had his posters on her wall. And there was like all these boos from the crowd. I thought, and I wasn't 100% sure who Justin Bieber was. I didn't really get what was going on. And then I was having this shouting in my ear, and I remember the floor manager like doing this thing like diving action. And what they wanted me to do, they were throwing, because there was a thing called Genie's Army, and they used to throw all these soft toys, you know, these emus and all sorts of little, you know, marsupials, fluffy toys onto the court. And it was to say to, the floor manager was trying to tell me, go and guide Genie to the fluffy toys behind you, because I couldn't see them. They were raining down behind me. And it was just carnage out there. And then the reaction to that question was just, I thought, absolutely ridiculous. It was, you know, I guess that's the world that we live in. I don't know if it was, I never thought it was particularly sexist or anything like that. I would have happily asked a young single guy, a Dimitrov, you know, is there anyone in the world he would like to date? I didn't think it was a big deal, but people really kind of sort of had a bit of a go at it. But you just have to go with.
I think it's great, Sam. I think it's great. I think we need a bit more of that. You need to do stuff to bring the personality out of the personalities. Don't you think so, John?
Absolutely. I don't know what the heck was wrong with that. I mean, I thought it was a very fair question.
You were hoping he was going to say you, John. That John Lloyd, in, you know, late 70s, early 80s, in those super tight shorts. I mean, you were number one pinup.
Well, you know, that's what happens when you get endorsed by a Japanese company, which I was in those days.
But you would have been way better than Justin Bieber. You were much higher up in the rankings.
Yeah, right. I wish.
Listen, before we go, Sam, just give me who's your tips for the US Open?
Oh, I'm always low. I think Djokovic will be strong. I also think Tsitsipas might be strong as well. He played very well down in the Ultimate Tennis Showdown in Nice, which was Patrick Mouratoglou's. I think he did a fabulous job being very innovative there, doing a lot of things that John was talking about, and got a lot of high-quality tennis. So I think he will be strong, but it's hard to see past Djokovic. And because I think he'll be quite pleased at the crowd in a funny way. I think it helps him that the crowd are not there. If he was playing, most of the crowd is not against him, but they're usually for the opponents. I am always very nervous to write off Serena, and I certainly wouldn't do that. I just feel with every slam that's passing, it becomes harder for her. And I do think it's just getting more and more difficult. Physically, she's in unbelievable shape, the best that she's been since she won Australia in 2017. Thought she looked in unbelievable shape, but the game is she's going to have to work very hard to get the game up to level. I have to say, I haven't thought heavily about the women's, but I would say Sonia Kenin, who won the Australian Open. Mm. I'm looking really for more personalities who are adaptable, flexible, who roll their sleeves up and they don't mind that they can't go to their favorite restaurant and they can't do this and they can't do that. And they just don't care about all that stuff, you know, rugged characters, quite laid back, and that can deal, because they're going to probably change the protocols during the fortnight. There's going to be all sorts of left field things. So it's who will deal with that situation. I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't mind seeing an American winner in the men's. I think that would be amazing. It's been a long time, and a shot in the arm for the sport. But I think get ready and hang on in those 2 weeks. It's going to be crazy.
John, who do you fancy? Yeah.
Well, I mean,
don't say Eugenie Bouchard.
No. I would have thought that this will be the most, I mean, realistically, the most open in history, in all probability, because, you know, quite simply, the players have just not played enough. And on the men's side and the women's, yeah, there's been a couple of things. There's been team tennis, a couple of little tournaments here and there. Djokovic had his exhibition thing that went on. But it's not the norm. And the top players, the reason why the top players are the top players in a lot of cases is because throughout the year, they're used to getting to the semi-finals, finals of these tournaments. So they're match tough. There's a toughness about them. Well, they haven't had that toughness now because there's been this break for such a long time. Yeah, mentally they're still tough, but it's slightly different. Having said all that, I would agree with Sam. Djokovic would not be out there. I don't think he's happy, to be honest, in some ways about being at the Open. But I think all these top players, they crave records. Anybody, whenever they tell you that they don't, they're liars. This is what they're obsessed with. And he must be looking at it now. Federer out, obviously, with the injury. Nadal out. He's got to be thinking this is a great opportunity for him. I think he'll win it. But if he doesn't, I mean, it's a wide open draw. And I mean, we could have an upset, I think, in the men's and women's, someone coming through that we're not expecting just because of the circumstances. In the women, Sophia Kenin was at Team Tennis. So I saw her for 3.5 weeks. And I agree entirely what Sam said. And that was the person I was going to pick before she jumped in ahead of me and said that. Sam, because you knew I was going to pick her. No, I'm just kidding. But I watched her for 3.5 weeks. Her father was with her. What a pro she is at such a young age. I mean, she's won the Australian, but she was out there. The practice she was putting in during Team Tennis, every day she was in the gym. Her father was there. The intensity was amazing. And plus, she had a lot of matches during Team Tennis. I know it's only one set, but she had singles and doubles under pressure situations. But for me, she's the favourite in the women's. And Serena, you know, it would be special if she won it. But I'm not so sure. I think I can't see her winning another Grand Slam, to be honest. So I think Kenin is, for me, the favourite in the women's. But wouldn't surprise me if someone outside the top 10 in the men or women come through with a title.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, if you're talking about outsiders, Danielle Collins is rugged. She's tough. You know, she's a street fighter. As long as she doesn't take a detour to the pharmacy, she'll be absolutely fine and break the bubble. I think she's got a chance.
She is one heck of a player. And I also like this Jennifer Brady, who just won. She played brilliantly in Team Tennis. And also look in the men's for Brandon Nakajima. Look for him. He played at Team Tennis, and he's another one that just is learning his craft day by day and maturing. I can see him maturing in the 3 weeks when I saw him in Team Tennis. And he is going to be, I predict, a top 10 player within a year or 2 years. And he could cause some serious damage in this event.
And coached by Pat Cash, of course.
A lot of people are going to talk about the women's Coco Gauff. But I got to tell you, I watched her last week in Lexington. She is amazing for 16, but she is nowhere near ready to win a slam. I could be eating my words, but I honestly...
Can I give you my prediction?
Yes.
Well, I think Kenin is she's got to be favourite for the women's. Obviously, the one thing about Djokovic, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, is that he's so good at Australia. And let's be honest, Australia is the one slam where players don't really have a good run up to the, in terms of match play. So that's why he's got to be such a huge favourite. But I'm going to go for Dominic Thiem. I think he will win either the US or the French Open. But my heart tells me that if there's an outsider to win, I've got to go with Denis Shapovalov.
All right.
I think the irony of this, often it's the non-ex-player that is usually gets it right. I remember John Wertheim at the Tennis Channel. He was the only pundit, and he's not an ex-player, he's a most brilliant journalist. He had greats around him, Chris Evert, Martina, and he was the only one that had Yelena Ostapenko in one of his sort of box picks to win the French Open. Everybody else got it wrong, and he can't hit a ball.
He can't hit a ball.
Well, I can hit a ball.
Love it.
Probably not very well. But anyway, listen, I love the sport. I'm grateful for you, Sam, for coming on, because, like I said, I really do enjoy watching you and hearing you on our coverage. Keep it going. And listen, thank you so much for the time. Sorry about keeping you too long. But hopefully we can sort of do this again soon, I hope.
That's all right. I think the smoke coming out the oven, you know how domesticated I am. I put something in about an hour ago and I think it should have come out about 20 minutes ago. So I'll just call the fire brigade and we'll be absolutely fine, Keith.
So you John, still haven't found out how to cook?
No, I'm just, I'm so under, I've got better in lockdown, but I'm still useless. John, it's lovely. It's lovely to chat with you. I can't wait to see you next time with maybe another new piece of, another new limb or whatever you're going to put, your hip or...
Yes.
New metal, new extra metal. And Keith, thank you very much for having me. It's been actually a lot of fun.
All right, well, listen.
You survived your Essex sandwich really well.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. You were gentle with me, and I'm very grateful. Listen, Sam, keep safe, keep well, and I'll look forward to hearing you on Amazon Prime over the next few weeks.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, guys.
Take care, Sam. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much to Sam Smith. It was great having her, and no doubt we will be speaking to her again soon. And thank you for listening. Thank you, John. And of course, we'll see you all next week. Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis, and of course on Instagram, rock'n'roll_tennis. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We will, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.